Hey y'all, how's it going? Well, good. Me, I'm doing all right, thanks. Can't believe it's already time to start. It's already time to stop reading and start doing the show. Or starp doing both of them, whichever. However you prefer to hear it, you know. Hey, so I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM. That's the truth. All right. Also, I'm at ScottHorton.org. That's my website. I keep all my interview archives there and my whole show archives and a lot of other stuff, too, including the chat room where you can hang out during the show if you want. That's at ScottHorton.org/chat. Stop by there, click on a bunch of things, including some ads, maybe. And, join up the chat room, scotthorton.org/chat. You don't need any special program or application. You don't have to download anything to your boss's computer at work. Just a plain old browser window will do ya. scotthorton.org/chat. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Follow me at liberty.me, at scotthorton.liberty.me. Or liberty.me/members/Scott Horton Show. And yeah, stuff like that. Okay. Today on the show, Daniel, I don't know how you say it. Hakikachu. Hey, maybe that's it. Hakikachu. It's HakikaJou. Hakikachu. Wow, wouldn't that be cool if I got it right? And that was it? It's probably not it. It's probably completely different than that. I'm going to introduce him as Daniel H. And then he can tell us the rest. But he wrote this great thing. Did you see this? Did you hear about this? This guy, Graham Wood, wrote a thing in The Atlantic, which I saw him backpedaling on Fox yesterday, which I thought was big of him. He seems to have taken criticism of his article quite well, judging from his Twitter feed and such. From what I've seen, he's been retweeting articles that are critical of his article, and good ones. And then I saw him yesterday on Fox News saying, well, I should emphasize that ISIS, what they think is contrary to what all other Muslims have ever thought, and same goes for the billion plus of them that exist on Earth right now. No one agrees with these guys. There's only a couple of 10,000 of them, and yeah. Well, the article doesn't quite read that way. The article, depending on your bias, it'll confirm your bias, let's say. What ISIS really wants, they're saying it's like the most widely read article on ISIS ever anywhere, which is really a shame because there's been some really great stuff written. But they're also saying it may be one of the most widely read Atlantic articles ever. Like, really? It's that viral, huh? And people really like being told what they want to hear. Well, so we're going to have Daniel Hakikachu on the show today to talk about his piece, What is Islamic? A Muslim Response to ISIS and the Atlantic. And it's co-written with Dr. Yasir Qadi. His name seems a little bit easier to say. Anyway, so Daniel's going to be on the show, and I like this because it's in nice, simple, easy, listicle format for us. Let's just go through, was it 1 through 10 or whatever? 1 through, 20? How many we got here? 21. Let's just go down the list and get this right. Thank you. Okay. We got another interview sort of along those lines, but different. And that's with Musa Al-Gharbi. He's going to be on to talk about the Islamic State as well, but not the Atlantic's misconception of it and Islam and all of that junk. But instead, he's going to be talking about why, indeed, because it's such a mystery, at least to the guys on TV, the Islamic State keeps trying to pick a fight with all their surrounding enemies. where they don't have one before. What are they, crazy or something? Well, Musa Al-Gharbi will be on to talk about the strategic logic of suicide terrorism. Yep. And Eli Clifton will be on to talk about this brand new piece. This is very important. I'm trying to keep it on the front burner here as best I can for you. The nuclear negotiations with the Iranians and all of that. And this one is by Eli Clifton, our old friend Eli Clifton. Haven't spoken to him in a long time, but have spoken with him many times before. It's by him and our other old friend, Ali Gharib. Both of these guys, yeah, they're liberals, but I love them, man. Especially, they're both great, just great on Iran issues. And Eli is one of the guys that wrote the original version of that fear thing, you know, Fear 2.0. I interviewed the lady the other day about it. Well, he helped write the first one about the Islamophobia industry in America for the Center for American Progress and the Think Progress blog. You know, honestly, if you go back that Think Progress blog, before, especially before Obama, but even a few couple of years into Obama, they had some really great Iran nuclear stuff coverage. And I think it was mostly because of Ali Gharib and Zay Jilani. But they ended up getting canned over the Israel First or pretend scandal and this and that. So anyway, and I know the Center for American Progress is nothing but AEI for the Democrats or something. That's all it is a giant Democratic Party partisan think tank. But they have employed decent journalists in the past to do good work. So I give credit where it's due there. Try to make alliances where it's worthwhile. And anyway, so here's Eli Clifton and Ali Gharib writing for Greenwald at The Intercept. And the article is The Long March of the Yellow Jackets, How One-Time Terrorist Group Prevailed on Capitol Hill. And, of course, it's about the Mujahideen-e-Khalq communist terrorist cult that used to work. Well, I don't want to give the story away. They're the guys who came out with the scare story about the secret Iranian enrichment program that Fox News made such a big deal out of, at least the last 2 days. I don't know if they've mentioned it today, but of course it's already completely debunked. Total nonsense. And ridiculous nonsense, in fact. But we'll talk about all that with Eli Clifton later on the show. Okay, so now, sorry, I only have a couple of minutes to cover this. And I guess I can start again in the next segment, but I had some other things to talk about in the next segment too. But anyway, so here's the deal. The deal is that Mike McNulty has died, and rest in peace and all of that for him. And I want to take at least a minute here to, you know, mention that his life was, well, worth living like everybody's, I guess. But that, you know, he deserves to go down in history in a way or whatever. As James Bovard wrote at his blog and at antiwar.com, he was a hero on the story of the Waco massacre. You talk about good journalism. Here's the guy that proved that everything they said about what they did to the Branch Davidians was a damn lie. And if you go to scotthorton.org/documentaries, or just go to the top of the page and you'll see video. It's a little pull-down menu, and the choices will be my speeches or documentaries. I didn't make any of the documentaries there. I'm not claiming I did. I'm just trying to show you good movies you might want to watch is all. And if you go to page 2 or 3 or something there, you'll find the Waco movies. And there's 3 of them by Michael McNulty. And if you've never seen them, you owe it to yourself. I think, I don't know. I suggest you watch them. Waco, The Rules of Engagement. Waco, A New Revelation. And then the third one is The FLIR Project. It's only a little more than half an hour. But that's the one. And it used to never be on YouTube. It used to be you could only get one part of it on YouTube. But now the whole thing is there. And it is the absolute ironclad beyond a shadow of a doubt proof. Not just of the murder of the Davidians, but the cover-up too. And it's just heroic work. And so, you know, in honor of Mike McNulty. By the way, you can listen to an hour and a half long interview I did of him too, if you want. Anyway, more about that in just a sec. It's the Scott Horton Show. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The first of these great workshops is in Orlando, Saturday, March 7th. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm so sorry. Thank you to Jared in the chat room for letting me know that the file, the MP3 file, was dead. Bad link. I am re-uploading right now. I got my McNulty. I could have swore I had more than one interview of him, but apparently I only did have the one. But it's an hour and a half long, and I don't know why it's not on the server, but it's been a long time since 2007. I don't know what all has happened, but I'm re-uploading it right now. It's at 78%. Jared, hit refresh, man, and then click that link right now and tell me if it's working, because I'm done uploading. Please let me know if the link is fixed. And then he's right to point out that the interview is also on YouTube if you wanted to hear it there. But I urge you, please, watch these documentaries, Waco, The Rules of Engagement, Waco, A New Revelation, and The FLIR Project. And if you can, I don't know, get them on Netflix or whatever and watch them in high quality, especially the second and third one there, and watch them in HD or something like that, the best quality you can get, you'll appreciate that so that you can watch the FBI agents and the Army Delta Force operators get out of the back of their tanks and massacre the Branch Davidians with machine guns and burn their house down. And anyway, so listen, Mike McNulty actually got in. Here's how he got into Waco. There's a documentary called Waco, The Big Lie, which you can't even call it a documentary because it's a joke, and the lady who made it is a joke. And, in fact, it's really too bad because one of Bill Hicks's best routines is based on this footage, that supposedly shows the Bradley tank shooting fire like a flamethrower out of its, tank nozzle or whatever. And it's clearly not. It's doctored footage. She colored it orange, but it's just a piece of cloth that's billowing in the wind that's, hanging off of the front of the Bradley, gun. And so Bill Hicks has that great thing about, you know, I've seen this footage with my own eyes and my squeegee third eye of the Bradley tank shooting fire into the compound. So that's actually not true. They were shooting gas and that was just some doctored footage. But it doesn't matter because Bill Hicks is still 99% right. And the stupid lying lady who faked that footage, she's still 99% right anyway, because yeah, they did set the fire, the cops, and they did machine gun those people to death, and they did even plant a bomb on top of the one concrete room that they had where only women and children were hiding from the poison gas, and they set off a bomb. You might even remember the big fireball. That was from the propane tank that also was detonated by the explosive. That was a secondary explosion from the bomb that Bill Clinton sent the Army Delta Force to murder these people with. And Mike McNulty proved it. And here's the thing about it, man. Everyone who believed otherwise about that at all, they were wrong. Not only that, they were damned fools. They were damned fools. Like, you know when Kim Jong-il died and all the North Koreans went outside to cry because dear leader, their God on earth had left them and oh, boo-hoo. That's how pathetic the American people are. Exactly as pathetic as a bunch of North Koreans who let your government tell you the most blatant lies about when they butcher women and children to death, and you just want to believe it's so damn bad, you and your mom and your dad and your uncle and your brother-in-law and everybody. Oh, them Branch Davidians, they're a crazy cult. They all committed suicide, just like Jonestown. I saw it on TV. And the opinion polls had super majorities of the American people approving of the tank attack, even though that one way or the other led to a fire that killed 80 people. Texans. The best kind of humans. The most rights-having kind of humans of all. But nope. because government said enemy. Government said their little plywood shack was a compound. Like the Branch Davidians were a foreign nation that had invaded Texas and were going to conquer it if our government didn't stop them. And the American people wanted to believe. It's not just racism, because, of course, they never really told the people that half the Davidians were black in there, because if they did, they risked, provoking the civil rights movement. What was left of it at the time. So they kind of covered that up. Because it was Democrat times, you know, Bill had just come into power. But they just said, hey, look, these people are a threat. We want to kill them. Can we kill them? And the American people said, yes, kill them. And I was sacking groceries at the time, and all of the upper middle class white women of Northwest suburban Austin, Texas were perfectly happy to see every last man, woman, and child in there extinguished one way or the other so they could get back to their game shows and their soap operas. This siege has taken 6 weeks already. I say just go in there and end it, they would say, with blood dripping out of their mouths. He said he was Jesus. Go in there and nail him to a tree. They all agreed. Oh, and the women and children surrounding him? Well, they're just collateral damage, right? That was the attitude. And anyway, I'm sorry, I'm off on a tangent. The Waco is the crime. McNulty's the hero. McNulty's three movies, they told the truth. And in fact, provoked a whole brand new, renewed cover-up 6 years after the original series of crimes in 1999 when Senator John Danforth came and did his big fake investigation, which is completely thrash and disproven, and John Danforth will go down in history as completely and totally disgraced by Part 3, the FLIR Project, which shows Danforth's conspiracy and obstruction of justice in order to continue this corrupt cover-up of the mass murder of these women and children. Guilty, guilty, guilty. Shit. You can turn on MSNBC and watch Jim Cavanaugh, the ATF guy who ordered the raid to go ahead up there as a civil rights expert and policing expert during the Ferguson controversy last summer after the murder of Mike Brown. I gotta turn on my TV and see Jim Cavanaugh up there explaining about professionalism in police work. Anyway, Mike McNulty, rest in peace, and if you believe in the afterlife, I hope you get there and all that stuff, because good work. All right, what the hell. And then as long as I'm on that topic, they say that Oklahoma City was just revenge for Waco and, in fact, justified Waco after the fact by some kind of mysterious time travel magic and collective responsibility and ridiculous nonsense and propaganda. But anyway, there's a lot more to that story. And you might have suspected all along that didn't it seem kind of funny how there was a John Doe 2 that was the biggest manhunt in world history and then evaporated completely. And then the FBI decided there was no John Doe 2 at all. And didn't you remember thinking that maybe they were lying when they said that McVeigh's closest co-conspirator was two states away at the time of the bombing? And didn't you think that maybe they weren't telling you the whole truth? Yeah, of course, that's because all of McVeigh's friends were Nazis. And like all Nazis, they're all either undercover informants pretending to be Nazis, or they're flip states witnesses and otherwise compromised by the feds. And the feds are compromised by them as well. So big cover-up, blame the one guy. And Jesse Trinity's on the case, and now the music's playing. I don't even have time to tell you. But it's at Fox 13. Did the FBI tamper with a witness in the OKC bombing evidence case? Yes, they did. Go read it. Did the FBI tamper with a witness? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm sorry, man, I wish the show was still 3 hours. Before we get to our first guest, let me just say real quick that over at The Intercept, they've got a hard news story about the FBI entrapment of yesterday. And they've also got an opinion piece by Glenn Greenwald. I think the news story is already running at antiwar.com. The opinion piece by Greenwald will be running tomorrow as well to go along with it. But I always like to point out that Trevor Aronson from Mother Jones has written the book on this. It's called The Terror Factory, and he shows that there have been more than 50, probably closer to 60 now, cases of outright entrapment by feds in these fake terrorist busts. And there have been many, many, many bogus prosecutions, hundreds. But there are, you know, near 60 where there is just outright entrapment, as opposed to just a lying informant or, you know, whatever else. But anyway, so it's a very important story, and both of the articles that they're running at The Intercept about it right now are extremely important. And then, well, this other stuff's just going to have to wait till tomorrow. Okay, our first guest on the show today is from MuslimMatters.org and is co-author of an article, What is Islamic? A Muslim Response to ISIS and the Atlantic. Daniel, welcome to the show. I won't try and fail to say your last name. Could you say it for me, please? Oh, I hit the wrong button. Now welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the last name is pronounced Haqiqat in Jew. So it's a mouthful for sure, but thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I was not going to be able to get that right, but but thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate this article. There have been a few different articles pushing back against the Atlantic piece, but I really like how you just kind of take us through it in listicle format here. It's the best way to get our head around it, I think. Yeah. Why not? So I guess, first of all, if you could, please tell the people very briefly about this article in The Atlantic by Graham Wood, What ISIS Really Wants, and then we'll get to the objections here.
Sure, yeah. So what we're trying to do with this piece is really try to put some context behind The Atlantic's essay from Wood, and really try to show that, you know, he presents it as a kind of theological analysis of ISIS. And really, you know, there's no problem in that in and of itself. You know, of course we need to understand these violent groups in order to fight against them or to, you know, be protected against them. But he's going further and he's saying that, well, ISIS is actually Islamic. And this is dangerous because I'm a Muslim. I'm living here in Los Angeles. My family's here. There's millions of Muslims in the United States, and we all practice Islam. So if you're telling the people, the American people at large, that look, this violent criminal group is actually following the teachings of Islam, then that raises a lot of suspicion about Muslims here, and it's dangerous. It's you know, breeding Islamophobia. We saw a lot of hate crimes recently directed against American Muslims, and also in Europe and France, a lot of violence directed toward our communities. So this is dangerous. It's alarming. And what was particularly egregious about Wood's piece is that he's kind of presenting it as objective reporting, because it's nothing new. I mean, there are a lot of different bigots out there talking smack about Muslims and Islam, but he was kind of taking this more, you know, supposedly objective route. And we kind of wanted to uncover, you know, what's really going on underneath that surface or that facade.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's been a huge article, and it's getting, you know, mentioned all over the place. I read somewhere they're saying it may be the most widely circulated Atlantic piece ever. And I just want to hit myself on the head when I read this. Now, and the thing of it is there's a lot of truth in the article. It's mostly, it seems like the lie is by omission. I think that's a lot of y'all's criticism, is what's not in there. And to be fair to Wood, although he kind of doesn't deserve it, but it seems as though since he wrote this thing, he's been very happy to retweet and acknowledge all these criticisms against him. And I saw him on Fox News where they thought they were going to bring him on to give us some good old fashioned, you know, Daniel Pipes, Frank Gaffney, Muslim bashing. And the first thing he said was, now listen, ISIS and their view is completely contrary to everything that every other Muslim has ever believed since the religion was invented, including all the billion something of them that live on the planet today right now. So let's just get that clear. So yeah, too bad he didn't start the article that way. But at least now he seems to be backpedaling a little bit. Sorry, there's no Muslims who have ever agreed with these guys ever. But yeah, no, they're Islam distilled though. I guess every other Muslim doesn't believe in their own religion. You're all just a bunch of, you know, Easter Sunday types, and that's it.
yeah, precisely. And he has kind of backpedaled a little bit. I mean, in the article, original article, he has one line that says, you know, nearly all Muslims don't agree with ISIS. But I mean, the damage is done. Like, you've already put out this piece, and he's gotten a lot of, you know, coverage on Fox News and other outlets like that. So it's really playing into this kind of agenda that's been, you know, laid out for him. And he kind of plays the part really well as this kind of academic, like, you know, even leaning left voice that agrees with us that, you know, it is really Islam that is the problem. And, you know, so it's
that
dangerous.
Famous Cheneyite, even the New York Times says kind of thing, right? Even
yeah,
the
exactly.
Liberal Atlantic admits that this isn't George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton's fault that we have a problem with terrorism. This isn't because Madeleine Albright went on TV and gloated and mocked the Arab and Muslim people of the Middle East and said, yes, 500,000 dead children is worth it for a policy that is obviously not working to remove Saddam Hussein anyway. No. It's not that a bunch of American monsters butchered and starved a million people to death and laughed about it. That's not the problem. The problem is this terrible perversion, break-off of Judaism and Christianity, this Islam. It's, you just got it all wrong, obviously, or else how come you're all so violent?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's kind of the narrative here that Wood's Atlantic piece is really serving. And I mean, the irony is that even when it comes to President Obama, you know, just recently there was this countering violent extremism summit that they had in Washington. And what was alarming to a lot of Muslim groups, advocacy groups in the U.S. is that it focused heavily on Muslims and, you know, this idea that there's this threat of homegrown terrorism, which, you know, we haven't seen. We've seen a lot of FBI entrapment, as you mentioned, but it's, you know, ironic that we have a president and he says, like, I don't want to use the term Islamic terrorism to describe ISIS or Islamic. I don't want to call ISIS Islamic. And that's what Obama has said. But in the past, you know, he has called on Muslims to denounce ISIS, which, I mean, Muslim groups have been for quite a while, but still, like, he makes that connection with Islam. And, you know, why should Muslims in particular have to denounce ISIS? Why can't we look at, you know, American foreign policy and see that as, in a big, big, major way, culpable for the rise of this group? I mean, there's also been a lot of turmoil in that region for decades. It's not just, you know, Obama's fault that this group has come along at this time. But still, like, even with Obama, you have this focus on American Muslims. And in the piece, we describe this as kind of a McCarthyism reborn here, where as opposed to communists being under the spotlight or alleged communists, now Muslims are the alleged terrorists, or we're, you know, guilty right. until proven innocent. We have to be the focus in these countering violent extremist summits. And even in, back in 2011, there were sessions in Congress looking at this issue of the American Muslim community. So, right. I mean, a lot of dynamics there.
All right. Yeah. And that's a great place to pick this interview up on the other side of this break. We're talking with Daniel H. from MuslimMatters.org. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And we're talking about ISIS and Islam and what white non-Muslim Atlantic writers write about ISIS and Islam with Daniel H., co-author of this piece at MuslimMatters.org. What is Islamic? A Muslim response to ISIS and the Atlantic. And when we were interrupted by the break there, Daniel, you were talking about this McCarthyism kind of witch hunt atmosphere, and you're absolutely right. And it to me, it's so manufactured and obvious that, you know, because there are no enemies really, you know, they have to kind of make them up. And where, you know, the Soviet Union actually existed, and when they had their alliance with the Chinese, they dominated a good third of the planet under their communist totalitarianism. There is no Islamo-fascist caliphate, except for now, finally, over the last year, there's arisen one in the worst part of the worthless desert of Iraq that's left over after the Shiites took Baghdad with George Bush's help. And you know, the eastern part of Syria, where they have one major city, and all of the rest of Syria is still under the control of the government there. And so this is the Islamo-fascist caliphate that we're all supposed to be so terrified of, that we all know that our government created, you know, indirectly in the first, well, and somewhat directly in the first place. And so, well, what the hell? How about hate and fear your neighbor? How about all Muslims here and there are out to get you? It's good you mentioned McCarthy, because that's trying to pretend that the Kremlin was in your neighborhood somehow, when communism had gone way out of style by then anyway. The chance of communists having real, you know, power and influence in America by the era of Joe McCarthy was long gone. So anyway, it's the same kind of level of nonsense, and yet I'm still only looking at it from a privileged, supposedly a white guy with an English surname. I'm not having to live under this. I'm just watching on the sidelines appalled. But I wonder, you know, how bad it sucks to be Muslim in America and be under this cloud of suspicion raised by these liars, these propagandists.
Yeah, I mean, it is frightening. You know, my first name is Daniel, and if you probably saw me on the street, you wouldn't know that I'm a Muslim unless I told you. But as for my wife, for example, or other family members, my wife wears the hijab or the Muslim veil, and you know, we do get dirty looks, and it's kind of scary with the shootings that happened in Chapel Hill. Pretty much, you know, it seems clear as a hate crime that Craig Hicks, the shooter, was, you know, upset, or he was angered by the fact that the husband and wife, the wife was wearing the veil, the Muslim veil, and that enraged him, and he went on this kind of shooting rampage. So that was a terrible tragedy, and it really rocked the American Muslim community. And so, you know, we have to worry about, look, is there anyone following us? Is anyone, you know, trying to keep tabs on us? It's very frightening. And I mean, other groups have gone through this before in the past. I mean, look at World War II, Japanese internment. We haven't reached that level yet, thank God, for Muslims. But I mean, there's, you know, the discourse that's happening around us is very hatred, you know, a lot of hatred, a lot of fear that's being peddled to the American people. And it's, you know, it's sad that your own neighbors can't, you know, look at you with suspicion.
Mm. Well, and the whole thing is such a mess too, because, and especially if you're asking somebody who is even susceptible to this kind of propaganda to then, you know, discriminate in a careful way, I mean, you know, they end up just attacking Sikhs, or, you know, they don't realize, for example, most American Arabs are Christians, not Muslims. And most American Muslims are Asian, not Arabs. And yeah. This kind of thing, you know, like they just end up lashing out at people who've done nothing, or you end up with FBI agents targeting people who are from communities, like in the Lodi, California entrapment case, where the Pakistani community in Lodi had been there for generations, right? And then all of a sudden, they're treated as this alien presence, like they all just landed there from Mars or from, you know, enemy land across the sea or something. And it was only because the FBI themselves had drummed up this fake crisis by infiltrating an informant into the community that had it was minding its own business.
Right, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's just an example of pure racism. And people sometimes ask, well, Islam is a belief, you know, it's a religion, it's not a race. How can you be racist against Muslims? Well, you know, you see non-Muslims who look brown, who are brown and look Muslim, they're getting targeted. It's not like bigots are interrogating their victims as to what they believe. So it is, you know, the manifestation, the ugly face of racism, you know, that has plagued our country for centuries.
Yep. Well, and you know, and it only takes a certain amount of the population to really believe in it, to kind of get everybody else to think that, well, there must be kind of something to it if they don't know anything about it. And, you know, like you mentioned how often in the article you guys talk about how, you know, organized, you know, Muslim groups constantly denounce extremism and terrorism, and yet are constantly accused of never denouncing terrorism. And of course, it's all BS anyway, right? Like, you know, your next door neighbor does something, you don't owe me an apology for that anyway. That doesn't mean anything anyway. But of course, people, you know, the organized groups are doing everything they can to prevent themselves from being even further marginalized by trying to get out ahead of these accusations, but still doesn't seem to do any good.
Yes, I mean, that's the frustration, is that there, you know, Muslim groups, even before 9/11, like even with the Oklahoma City bombing, there are Muslim groups that were denouncing that, you know, as, you know, an act of terrorism, even though that Muslims weren't involved with the Oklahoma City bombing. But even back then, you know, Muslims have been constantly and regularly denouncing terrorism and this kind of egregious violence. But, you know, that message falls on deaf ears. And at some point it just becomes like banal. It becomes tiresome to engage in this kind of back and forth of, you know, these accusations, unfounded accusations against Muslims, and then having to constantly apologize. It puts you again in this kind of psychology that you're always under suspicion, and that has major impact to, you know, the psychological health of the American Muslim community. So we shouldn't, you know, forget that aspect. And other, you know, racialized minorities experience that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? Let me double back and try to play devil's advocate some more on this theme.
Sure.
There's this expert, Bernard Haykel, who says, and you quote him in here from the Atlantic article, saying that, hey, man, the people who deny that ISIS is, you know, to their very bones, Islamic, you know, and Islam in practice, why, they're just basically lying about their own religion. They have a cotton candy view of their own religion, and that all of this stuff is straight out of the text. So, I mean, is that right? Is it not the case that, I mean, after all, Caliph Ibrahim has a PhD in Islam from Baghdad University, they say, and all of this. So, they sure call themselves the Islamic State. Maybe you're just, you know, it's not your flavor of Islam, and so you're in denial and not willing to admit the, you know, profound, radical Islam fundamentalist extremism terrorism going on here. What about that?
Yeah, so this Bernard Haykel, I mean, he's from Princeton. He's an academic there. And, it's, I mean, one connection, or one interesting connection, is that, you know, Bernard Lewis, one of the main, intellects behind the Iraq invasion, and one of the advisors to George W. Bush, was Bernard Lewis, also from Princeton. And so, you know, sometimes we have experience with academics misguiding our foreign policy, but that's just a side note. But as far as Haeckel here, you know, he's taking a very academic approach to what Islam and what is Islamic, and he basically admits within that article, as well as other supplementary clarifications he made that were quoted in thinkprogress.com. Basically, he says, look, as far as I'm concerned as an academic, if you're a Muslim and you just cite anything within the religious text, that's all it takes to be Islamic. Like, from an academic perspective, you're Islamic. And so he's using this very loose, broad definition of what is Islamic. And what we point out is that, look, if, you know, you can have any killer or mass murderer call themselves a Muslim and do all kinds of atrocities and maybe cite something in the Quran or the Bible, for example, or any other religious text, and then say, oh, yeah, this is an Islamic act, or this is a Christian act, or a Judaic act. And we wouldn't buy that. It's not, you know, that's not how we're using the term Islamic. When we say something is Islamic, we mean that it's, you know, implied, or it's the text and Islamic law is directing you to do this. And as it turns out, you know, all Islamic scholars, not just in the West, but even in the Arab world, in all over Asia, have denounced ISIS and said that, you know, what you're doing is not in accordance with Islamic law. And for Wood to just talk to a few, you know, as we call them, ISIS fanboys that he interviews, and then come up with a determination that, oh yeah, what they're saying is right and ISIS is Islamic, you know, that's completely biased, and it's not really objective reporting if you're kind of omitting all these other voices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, even in the article at the beginning, although he doesn't really develop the argument, or he kind of denies the importance of his own point, he compares ISIS and their view of Islam to sort of the Branch Davidians' view of the Bible, and not that they were murderers, they only defended themselves, but he's just saying no one would claim that just because David Koresh, you know, has even memorized massive parts of the Bible, that that means that he's gets to be the expert on telling what the rest of the world what Christianity is and means. No, actually, he had his few dozen followers, and that's about it. And if you had asked any other leaders of any other denominations of Protestants or Catholics or anybody else in America, they would have said, no, actually, that ain't quite right. And they would have found plenty of reason to explain why he doesn't deserve the influence he has over his group, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's kind of built right in there. And then he kind of turns around and ignores that point, that this is obviously, you know, a pretty bad break off. And then, of course, he doesn't bring up the context of any of the history. I don't even know if he really even brings up the second Iraq war, much less the first Iraq war and the era of the blockade and the sanctions and all the reasons that Al-Qaeda said that they attacked us in the first place, or even why it would be that the average Arab Muslim born in the 21st century would even look and listen to one of these crazy Salafist, Takfiri, whatever, Bin Ladenite radicals who advises you ought to die in battle soon instead of living a life. Why would they listen to them other than because there are explosions going off all around them and because people that they know have been killed violently by Americans or people in the Americans' employ, etc.? Why else would they target us? And that's the real lesson here, it seems to me. It's the same thing about Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl. They were the crazies in the basement in the Bush senior term, and they were allowed to kill people in South America, but they weren't allowed to mess with Middle East policy at all. But once September 11th happened and Paul Wolfowitz said, hey, we got the blueprint for what is to be done, people decided, hey, this guy seems to know what he's talking about, even though, of course, he didn't. But it's the same sort of thing here, that this is all, we're talking about real human beings in time and space. It's not like we were all floating on clouds living out of, you know, simply what books say. It's a planet. It's a war. And in this article, he just kind of forgets the war, that there's a freaking war going on here, man, and that there has been.
Yeah, I mean, the things that the Iraqi people have gone through, and now the Syrian people as well. I mean, I don't think that we living here have any conception of the horrors that they have experienced. I mean, just in terms of being occupied, you know, birth defects when it comes to the use of depleted uranium that the U.S. used in their munitions, causing these like nightmare inducing birth defects to your children. You know, you've had family members blown to bits or maimed, raped by soldiers. I mean, there's been a lot of cases of this, and it's just horrific. And a lot of the suicides that we see amongst U.S. military personnel is because of this kind of what they have seen, post-traumatic stress, and what they've done or been commanded to do by their superiors. And so it's very depressing on all sides. And then, you know, if you've experienced that kind of apocalyptic circumstance and that lived reality, then it's no surprise that you're going to have a warped sense of what, you know, life is and how to deal with it. That's not to excuse any of the atrocities and, you know, crimes that this group is committing, by no means.
Of course.
I'm not saying that, but it goes a long way in understanding and explaining kind of where they're coming from. And it's much more relevant to look at that as opposed to, like, you know, these guys citing a verse of the Quran, for example. Like, that's, you know, all Muslims read the Quran. Like, we're not all violent, murderous criminals like this. So what's the difference there?
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, by the way, and I'm sorry, we're over time, but if you could talk for just, I don't know, 30 or 45 seconds or a minute about, I guess we could do about a minute, about this joint letter that was signed by virtually every Sunni religious authority on earth last year about ISIS. Could you describe that, please? Because it did not get much play on TV, I don't believe.
Yeah, so basically all of these clerics are coming together and they're denouncing point by point, you know, on a theological level, why ISIS is wrong about the specific things that they do. Because, you know, they do cite texts and they do try to, you know, manipulate text to, you know, post hoc justify the crimes that they commit. So that's kind of a nitty gritty rebuttal to that. And I definitely recommend people read that who want to know the specifics there and how ISIS's, you know, crazed theology kind of connects, you know, to what they're doing and how actual religious authorities, Muslim authorities throughout the world have responded to that in detail, and then judge for yourself. And then also, I mean, one thing that Wood kind of implies is that Muslims who deny that ISIS is Islamic are kind of being politically expedient, and they're just saying that because they're living in the West and they don't want to kind of draw this heat to themselves. But, you know, a lot of these scholars signing this response to ISIS, this document, they're not living in the U.S. They're not living in Europe. They're from all over the world. They don't have this kind of agenda or this kind of self-preservation as a motive. They're just responding authentically to these religious arguments and providing rebuttals. So definitely check that out.
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry. We're way over time, but thank you so much for your time, Daniel. And say your last name for me again, please.
Haqiqat Ju.
All right. There you go. And he's at MuslimMatters.org, y'all. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
And we'll be right back with Eli Clifton in just a sec, y'all. Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America, columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at FusePowder.com. Hey, all right, at the very last second, I've made Skype contact. Stayed way over time with Daniel there. What a great interview, man. And you guys got to read this article again. It's at MuslimMatters.org. What is Islamic? A Muslim response to ISIS and the Atlantic. And we're going to have more on ISIS in a little while with Musa al-Garbi. But next up is our old friend Eli Clifton, now writing at The Intercept. Hi, Eli. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Very happy to have you back on the show. And so, by the way, what is your bio these days?
I'm actually based at the Nation Institute, which is a few short blocks away from the Intercept.
Okay, so good deal.
Collaborate with them.
Right on. And so here you have one with our other old friend, Ali Gharib. And if I can only find it in this massive pile of tabs here, it's at The Intercept. Again, that's firstlook.org/The Intercept. And the article is Long March of the Yellow Jackets, How a One-Time Terrorist Group Prevailed on Capitol Hill. And it's about the Mujahideen e-Calk, and it'll be running tomorrow on, actually maybe in the top news today at antiwar.com. It'll probably be running tomorrow too, if you want to find it there. Okay, so take us back in time. Tell us the story. What in the world is the Mujahideen e-Calk?
Well, that's a question I think a lot of people ask. And really, to go to their origins, you have to go back to the mid-1960s, when this was the Shah's Iran, and there were small groups of students, middle-class university students, all starting to organize and talk about sort of revolutionary religious tracts, how these were going to interact with one another. And a group came together under an Islamo-Marxist ideology, which was the initial group that formed the MEK, as they often go by, which means the Mujahideen e-Khalq, means Holy Wars of the People. And they recruited other young intellectuals, and some of them went off to training camps in the Jordanian and Lebanese deserts that belonged to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And in 1971, they started their attacks, as they were, against the Shah. They attacked a major power plant in Tehran. And by 1973 to 1976, they'd expanded this war against the Shah to the Shah's allies, who included the United States. In those 3 years, from 73 to 76, the MEK actually assassinated 6 Americans. 3 were military, and 3 were civilian contractors with the American company Rockwell International. All of this takes us through to the revolution, where there's a falling out between them and Khomeini, and they have to leave Iran. Many of them are executed. Many of them go to Paris, and eventually a lot of them wind up in the Iraqi desert in an alliance with Saddam Hussein by the 1980s, where they actually take up arms against Iran. And their organization becomes more and more inward-looking. It becomes what some people describe as cultish, and really focused on bringing their leaders, Massoud Rajavi and Maryam Rajavi, to retake, as they put it, Iran. And they start to frame themselves as the democratic leaders, while at the same time making themselves wildly unpopular with people in Iran. Because, as I say, they're fighting on the side of Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war. Needless to say, it doesn't work out so well for them. They're essentially used by Saddam to quell sectarian uprisings, including persecuting the Kurds. And by 1997, the State Department actually lists them as a terrorist group, leading them on a lengthy quest to get themselves off the terrorist list, which brings them in close contact with many U.S. members of Congress. And by 2012, they actually get themselves off the list, and which brings us sort of up to the current day, where they are able to actually wield a bit of influence on Capitol Hill, in this case, due to their proximity to Senator Robert Menendez from New Jersey. They are able to actually, it would appear that their influence over him may have played a role in slowing down the approval of Apache sales to the Iraqi military when they arguably needed the most to combat ISIS in early 2014. Mm-hmm.
And now it's interesting that, you know, Hillary ended up taking them off the terrorist list, but Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell never did. And in fact, well, I like bragging about her, but my wife, Larissa Alexandrovna, reported back years ago about how Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, not the CIA, but the military and the vice president, were using MEK as spies inside Iran. Others later reported, including a very Obama-approved leak, I believe, to NBC in 2012, that it was, in fact, the MEK working for the Israelis who were assassinating all the scientists inside Iran.
I mean, I think it's certainly true that they've worked with pretty much anybody who would align themselves with them, even on narrow sets of objectives. There certainly are a rich set of anecdotes of them collaborating with the Israelis, other even perhaps more questionable anecdotes about them cooperating more recently with the CIA. But just to turn back to the Bush administration for one moment, their presence in Iraq was even used as an example of Saddam Hussein harboring terrorists when there was discussion about the invasion of Iraq. So, they have this very mixed identity, and the way that even politicians here have used them rests on kind of two pedestals, as it were, one being an outright unawareness and naivete about who they are when they come to hearings and have their supporters, carpet the hill by just going from one office to the next lobbying. But then also their willingness to be opportunist and the fact that at various times, they have served as useful allies for various countries and various intelligence organizations, or so it would appear.
Yeah, and now as far as their big protests, it's been reported at least one time in the past that they really just rounded up homeless people and paid them $50 and gave them yellow shirts and said, help us fill out this crowd. So that's kind of a fun little anecdote to show, like, how easy it can be, I guess, to inflate your numbers and make it look like, as long as you're passing out big checks to congressmen to give speeches too, it helps, but have some influence up there.
When they hand out checks to U.S. politicians, these are usually politicians who are no longer in office. When they give it to politicians who are in office, it's in the context of campaign contributions.
Right.
Totally on the level then.
Sure, absolutely. Didn't mean to imply otherwise. all right, so now I should have started with this, Eli. I'm sorry, but one of the reasons this is very important, I guess you guys have been working on this for a little while anyway, but of course they're in the news because 2 days ago they gave a big press conference. Fox News was very impressed, at least 2 days worth of reporting out of it on Fox News. I'm sure all the AM top of the hour news stations were repeating it, that exposed by the NCRI, which is the MEK, a new secret uranium enrichment parallel facility that has been hidden from all of the inspectors inside Iran, right there in Tehran, actually. And the kids at the Daily Kos immediately, they just do a Google search. You can just right click and say search for this image, and Google went and found where the image of this vault door came from, and it was an advertisement from an Iranian safe company that said, we sell some really sturdy vaults, and here's a picture of them. And they just said, yep, here's a picture of the vault door, and just trust us, there are secret centrifuges behind that. And this is one of, I don't know how many times that they have done it. Do you have a ballpark on that? How many times the MEK has come up with some, has done like a press conference or a press release saying that they're exposing a secret part of Iran's nuclear program, and then it all fell apart?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure at this point it would require at least two hands to count the number, maybe more. I would say in their defense that at times, the intelligence that they provided has been more accurate than other times. Part of the problem, though, is they always present it the same way, which is that they have this new, their breathless announcement about a new, Iranian secret nuclear facility, which either in past occurrences has already been reported on in some contexts, or in others, maybe it is some new information, but the way that they spin it, they tend to overplay their hands in terms of what it is they claim to have found. And once again, this is all in the context of, this is a group that its sole and driving mission is to unseat the current government in Iran. And anything else that comes along the way, very much their attitude, which we allude to in our article, is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that pretty much the ends justify the means. Right. So anytime that they think they have something, they tend to play it up in a rather aggressive manner.
Right. All right. Now hold it right there. It's Eli Clifton from the Nation Institute, and we'll be right back in just a minute. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Over at The Intercept, that's firstlook.org/The Intercept. They got one by our old friends Ali Gharib and Eli Clifton. He spends most of his time at The Nation, but here he is writing at The Intercept. And this one's all about the MEK, Communist Terrorist Cult. Used to work for the Ayatollah, then they worked for Saddam Hussein, then they worked for Donald Rumsfeld, and then they worked for, I guess, Ehud Olmert, and now I guess probably they work for Netanyahu and or John Brennan. I don't know. Who do they work for now, mostly? Do you know?
Well, I mean, in case I've presented an unsympathetic view of them, they would work for themselves. And, you know, whatever flexibility they've had and who they've aligned themselves with, I think is largely a product of, you know, that they have a very narrow set of self-interested goals. And they're open to collaborating with just about anyone who they think will, help them further them.
Yeah. Well, that sure seems to be apparent here. Yeah. All right. Now, so, how was it that they got off the terrorist list? It seemed like, I mean, well, you already mentioned paying former politicians to give speeches, but it seems like that'd be pretty controversial to do because they were actually, you know, on the list at the time they were paying those former politicians to give those speeches. So how'd they get away with all that?
Well, you know, for the most part, when they funded former politicians, as it were, to give speeches often at their events in Paris, sometimes here in the U.S., everybody's understanding of it is that money is always transferred to them by groups that just happen to be supportive of the MEK, not the MEK itself, or by individuals who are supportive of it. And it's worth noting that in Europe, they weren't under the same restrictions during most of this time period that they were in the U.S., which made it far easier for money to be moved around, for money to be raised, for organizations to exist with the actual NCRI or MEK name on it. And for politicians to be handed large sums of money when they would attend the MEK's annual conferences or sometimes more often.
And remind the audience, if you would, about who some of these politicians and former politicians are who've been traveling around and associating with the MEK like this.
Well, I mean, certainly Patrick Kennedy, Howard Dean are some of the most well-known, Rudy Giuliani are some of the most well-known who did it. Probably the most influential, though, is former New Jersey Senator Bob Torricelli, who became the group's lobbyist. He was their he was the only client that he had for lobbying after 2012 or 2013. Was being compensated as much as $35,000 a month for doing that, and it seemed as if his primary contact on Capitol Hill was Senator Robert Menendez, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, good ally to have there.
A very valuable ally.
Yeah. All right, now, so as far as this group, it's funny, if you call them a cult, you'll get 10,000 of them will swarm on your Facebook page denying that they're a cult kind of thing. I interviewed, I forget the guy, Jeremiah Gulka, I believe. From the RAND Corporation, who helped do that study that you guys linked to here. God, I hope I got his name right. And he really talked about, he described them like they really are sort of, you know, much closer to Charles Manson or Bo and T than David Koresh as far as their cult-like control over here. All their members are sworn to, Gulka, I got it right, good. Their members are all sworn to celibacy. They're grown adults, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s. They have to raise their hand to ask permission to speak. And it's just, you know, the most insane kind of comic book sort of group of weirdos in the world or something like that. What do you think of that?
I mean, I've certainly heard similar stories. I have met with them in a very controlled environment. And I will say that, you know, they are all extremely the folks I met with were very successful. They were business people, very kind, very nice, very polite. And I think it's worth, you know, putting in sort of a sympathetic nod to them in that, you know, this is a group who has sort of been a sad footnote often in history, in recent history. They have been mistreated in Iraq. There have been attacks on them, certainly in the past several years. And this is a group that, you know, for so many of the people in the Iranian diaspora who are members of this group, you get the sense that Mariam Rajavi, at this point, the de facto leader of the group, is sort of controls and is their connection and their Iranian identity. So, I mean, the folks are all very nice. They are well-meaning. I think that one starts to get more of a sinister view of it when one starts to look at just the absolute power that it appears that the leadership seems to exert over the members, and even the ways that some of the members have spoken to me adoringly of Mariam Rajavi. It certainly raises questions, and it makes you wonder how exactly the group serves the interests of these members.
Well, I mean, there have been some reports, and I'm sorry, I only got to read about half of y'all's thing before the show started today, but there have been some reports where these people, you know, their kids get kidnapped and taken off across the world or something like that to keep people under control and this kind of thing, and, you know, pretty...
Yeah. I mean, it's this typical type of allegations you do hear about groups that are typically labeled as cults, the other one being the mandatory divorces, the forced celibacy, all of these types of things, you know, that you hear about in terms of cult-like behaviors that are designed in one way or another to form a system of sort of absolute control.
Yeah.
And I assume that there's a wide difference in terms of how members of the group are treated when they are, for instance, living in some small town in the United States and their connection is through the internet or by going to conferences versus their members who are in, a refugee camp in Iraq where right. There's absolute control over them. So there's probably a whole range there. But certainly the role and controls that Rajavi has over them is really quite striking and does raise plenty of questions and concerns.
And by the way, do you have any kind of estimate on how much support they have among the Iranian diaspora? I mean, we know they have absolutely no popular support inside Iran whatsoever, but what percentage of, say, American Iranians support them, do you think?
I certainly couldn't begin to offer a number. What I will say is that every Iranian American I've met who is not identified as a follower of Mariam Rajavi certainly speaks negatively of them. However, the MEK will claim that, at least within Iran, that they are extremely popular and that pretty much every political prisoner who is executed or put in jail is actually a secret member of their group. Once again, a hard thing to prove, but one that you might take with a grain of salt.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, I understand what you're saying about how, hey, you know, nobody's perfect and all that kind of thing, because, you know, and I can sympathize with any Iranian exile who hates the Ayatollah. I hate all politicians. If I was Iranian, I'd hate the Ayatollah too, since he'd be my Ayatollah or ex-Ayatollah, that kind of thing. But then again, these guys are always trying to foment wars and seemingly at the behest of the Israelis undermine peace efforts with their bogus press conferences like what happened the other day and that kind of thing. So, you know, they can mean well and be exiles trying to gin up controversy as best they can, and then I can resent them back for that, you know. If not, but you're right. I don't want to, like, just because the pattern of allegations against them is the same as the pattern of allegations against every so-called cult group doesn't mean that they're all guilty of all of those things. And I shouldn't, you know, go around oversimplifying that kind of thing either.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they're a complex group and they're a complex group of people. But their impact on U.S. policy, has been rather consistent. And, I think that right now they've exerted more influence than they ever have before, which is rather noticeable in that they seem to have actually perhaps played a role in influencing Robert Menendez to hold up the sale of Apache helicopters to the Iraqi military at a time when arguably the Iraqi military needed those Apache helicopters the most.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, all things being equal, but it's an important story just for their role in it and all that kind of thing. But anyway, so I already kept you over, but thanks very much, Eli. It's great to talk to you again, and a great piece of work here. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, y'all. That's Eli Clifton. He's at the Nation Institute, and here he is writing with Ali Gharib at firstlook.org/The Intercept, Greenwald's thing there, The Intercept, Long March of the Yellow Jackets, How a One-Time Terrorist Group Prevailed on Capitol Hill. We'll be right back in just a second with Musa al-Gharbi after this. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Musa al-Gharbi. He's a senior fellow with the Southwest Initiative for the Study of Middle East Conflicts. That is SISMEC.org. SISMEC.org. And he's got this great new piece. We ran it as the spotlight at antiwar.com, I guess, 2 or 3 days ago. Maybe over the weekend, Monday, I don't know. Anyway, the other day at antiwar.com, it's at america.aljazeera.com. It's called, and I think I mentioned it to you on the show the other day, it's called ISIL's Barbaric Acts Are Highly Effective Propaganda. Welcome back to the show, Musa. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me.
Good. Very happy to have you back on the show here. Very happy to read you talking sense to these people. I hope they were all paying attention. I hope they will. So tell us, as it says in the byline here, you're addressing the reasoning behind ISIS's torture and murder of this Jordanian pilot by fire, for one example. Anyway, are these guys just a bunch of madmen, or did they have some kind of purpose that it's worthwhile to try to understand and why they would do such a thing?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's important to understand, if you're trying to combat a group like ISIS, it's important to understand their strategic logic. And unfortunately, because if you don't understand their strategic logic, then you run the risk of having your own plans and actions sort of play into their hands rather than effectively weakening them. And ISIS has demonstrated itself to be an extremely strategic opponent. What's striking is that their strategic logic is clear, and they're pretty upfront about it. That's what I was talking to you about the last time I was on the show, was sort of, I wrote an article for Al Jazeera America called Obama is Playing into al-Baghdadi's Hands, or he's falling into al-Baghdadi's Trap. Mm-hmm. And it was at the beginning of this campaign, and I was pointing out that U.S. actions might be playing into ISIL's strategic logic. And unfortunately, over the past 6 months of the campaign, that has proven pretty prescient.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so, and this, we could go back all the way to the first World Trade Center bombing or the second one or what have you, but it all seems to me it's the same double-edged kind of strategy that Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, explained on the show way back when, that they're kind of not even really bothering with this, but it sort of is there that just leave us alone. This is a warning to stop or we'll keep fighting you. But really, they know better than that. They know that it's not really going to make people stop intervening. And so what it's really about is plan B, which is to provoke an overreaction in order to get, you know, the strong to stumble and fall and hurt himself against the weak in an asymmetric kind of a thing. And that was why it's so silly from the beginning after September 11th for them to pretend that this was just the cutting edge of the oncoming Islamo-fascist juggernaut, when in fact it was just a Hail Mary pass to try to get us to go and screw ourselves, which is exactly what we've done.
Yeah, I mean, what's striking about terrorism statistics is up until is that overwhelmingly terror incidents occur in the Middle East. I mean, there's very few of them that have occurred in Europe post 9/11. you know, in a Europe or America or any Western capital until Charlie Hebdo. I mean, that was the most recent one. But, you know, for Islamic terrorism, the biggest one in Europe since 9/11 was actually the Anders Breivik, the white Christian anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant sort of and went on a shooting spree. That was actually the biggest terrorist incident in Europe since 9/11. So they don't have a lot of ability to get over and attack, you know, America or Europe, despite the fear-mongering in the media. They just don't have that capacity, especially not in an organized way. So their goal, to the extent that they want to kill Americans or, you know, weaken America or anything like that, is to try to get us to go over there. So that's one aspect of it. But another aspect, which I tried to tease out in the article, is that what's critical for ISIS's sort of long-term viability is they need a constant influx of foreign fighters to come over to Iraq and Syria. And that's another aspect of when unpopular actors like dictators like al-Sisi or the Jordanian monarch or the United States, who are viewed as being tyrannical or imperial or something like that, when they do these kind of interventions in the Middle East, what you see is a lot of people who might not agree with ISIS's ideology or know a lot about it, or but they want to resist those powers. And so they tend to flood the market. And that's what we've actually seen since the U.S. bombing campaign began. Foreign fighters in Syria have skyrocketed, now more than 20,000 of them over the course of the campaign. So what we've been seeing is ISIS hasn't been, their manpower actually hasn't been reduced, but we've killed thousands of ISIS fighters, but they've got thousands of more. And the rate of recruitment has gone up as a result of the airstrikes. And that's exactly what they want.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, the idea, I mean, you could see how from the point of view, you could imagine the highest level ISIS, you know, military council of Baathists and lunatics and whatever saying, okay, now how bad of a fight with Jordan do we want to provoke? Because it makes sense they want to provoke a conflict with them, but they don't want to get annihilated. They just want to trip Jordan up the same way that they've gotten America to trip ourselves up. And then I don't know enough about Jordan, but it seems pretty obvious that, you know, over the long haul, even though if people are rallying around the king now to avenge the captive murdered pilot and all that kind of thing, over the long haul, the more the Jordanian Hashemite British and American sock puppet king intervenes against ISIS, the less popular he makes himself at home and the more credibility he gives to them, in a way maybe far beyond what you describe in terms of American airstrikes driving up their recruitment. This could be huge for them, right? And especially because they can portray the king of Jordan now as a sock puppet of the Iranians.
So here's what's mind-boggling. So the new Egyptian dictator, Fatah al-Sisi, has recently proposed that Arab states like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan form an Arab coalition to more forcefully intervene against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And again, like, they could hardly ask for a better gift. When you look at where ISIS recruits are coming from, the foreign fighters, they're overwhelmingly, Jordan is one of the top providers of jihadists to the al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda affiliate, and ISIS, both. Jordan is one of the top providers. Egypt has been providing increasing numbers of people since the coup, and the terrorism problem has gone in Egypt since the coup. Saudi Arabia continues to be the number one of the top providers of fighters to Iraq and Syria, and they were even in the 2003, you know, invasion occupation. The Center for Combating Terrorism found that Saudi Arabia was the number one country providing fighters to. So these dictatorial regimes, when they take part in this strike against ISIS, that's going to dramatically bolster the amount of their own citizens who hate these governments and view them as tyrannical. They're going to flood the region to fight those governments. What ISIL really wants, what would be sort of ideal for them, is to lure these fighters, and especially lure America into, or Europeans into committing ground forces to the conflict. Because the problem right now with
Hold it right there. I'm sorry. We got to take this break, Musa. But when we get back from this break, we will, in fact, talk about those ground forces and the entire PR stunt of dressing up the American occupation. Now, look, we've got all these Sunni kings fighting with us, so it's legit. more about that right after this break with Musa Al-Gharbi from Al Jazeera, america.aljazeera.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Musa Al-Gharbi, senior fellow at the Southwest Initiative for the Study of Middle East Conflicts. That's SISMEC.org. And here he is at america.aljazeera.com. ISIL's burning death of Jordanian pilot, strategic. Done quite deliberately, as horrible as it is. It's savage, but that doesn't mean it's thoughtless. That's the point. And you were saying before the break there that if ISIL gets exactly what they want, it'll be an American joint invasion with our allies in the region and a real war again in the so-called Sunni triangle of Iraq and now in eastern Syria. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Because so the thing with the airstrikes is they do have a propaganda value in helping to drive foreign fighters. But to the extent that they want to, like, to actually, but a bigger propaganda victory would be if they were able to sort of create a lot of casualties, if they were able to kill and capture a lot of Americans, to hold a lot of American soldiers hostage, to execute them very publicly. Same thing with Jordanians and Saudi Arabians and soldiers, so, you know, supporters of the of these oppressive groups as they see them. So what they would love, because with the airstrikes, you know, again, it's good propaganda, but you can't. It's very difficult for them to say shoot down a plane or shoot down a helicopter and seize the pilots. They were able to with this Jordanian guy, but that's despite all of these strikes by U.S. and coalition forces where they were not able to do that. So ground forces, it's much easier to capture and kill to drive up the casualty count, and that's what they're really after. That's what they would really love. That would not only drive up their foreign recruitment, but it would incur a great cost that would undermine the legitimacy of these actors. It would undermine the legitimacy, for instance, of Barack Obama or whoever that's in the White House if you started seeing large amounts of casualties in Iraq with no end in sight or Syria. It would undermine the King of Jordan for the same way. It would undermine Fatah al-Sisi. It would undermine the monarch of Saudi Arabia. So that's what they would really love, is to drive up casualty rates. And that requires a ground invasion. That's what they're really angling for.
Now, on the other hand, though, the Marines can kill the hell out of you, and that means Baghdadi and his best friends up at the top of this thing, too. Are they really willing to risk dying themselves in this? I mean, we're talking about politicians, after all.
Yeah, well, you know, what's interesting about these groups, so the CIA actually released a they didn't release. It was released on WikiLeaks, a CIA report evaluating the high-value targeting in Afghanistan from 2001 to 2008. It was released last month on BBC. What that report found is that groups like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda have sort of designed themselves survive if their leaders are killed. And in fact, what happens a lot of times when the leaders are killed is if a leader has been in charge of an organization for a long time, they tend to actually exert a moderating and conservative force on the group. And so when you remove the head, the surviving members actually usually become more extreme. It can make make room for people with new visionary ideas that make the group more effective or more more popular. And we've seen that with the Pakistani Taliban, but actually that's sort of the Al-Qaeda story as well. In a world where Al-Qaeda's leadership still exerted the sort of influence that it did or the sort of competition that it posed, the authority of people like Anwar al-Awlaki and Osama bin Laden, if they were still alive, it would make it more difficult for someone like al-Baghdadi to really kind of rise to prominence in the way he has. So ISIS has structured itself similarly to survive that kind of attrition. What's more effective when you're trying to combat these groups, and this is true of organized crime and also terror organizations, isn't to focus at the top or the bottom. Either one of those is going to be usually ineffective, but instead to target the sort of middle managers who work out the logistics of things rather than the symbolic heads and the sort of grand strategy people, but the people in the middle who work out the logistics. The problem is that those people are less visible. It requires a lot of intelligence to find out who they are, where they are. It's a lot harder to kill those people even than the people at the top. But if you were going to do sort of targeted killing, those sort of middle people are who you'd want to go for. Someone like Baghdadi, they would just make a martyr out of him, and they would sort of appoint a new caliph and move on. They might even get more recruitment if you killed the caliph and made him a martyr.
But here's the thing, though, and I'm trying to play devil's advocate here, and so I can just skip it and just sum up as I'll be first in line to accuse the Americans, first the Bush administration one way, then Obama the other, in creating this crisis and getting the whole region into this mess. But so with an eye toward, you know, non-intervention or hopefully the least amount of intervention possible by the Americans in this, how do you see this ending? Because it seems like, you know, the way Patrick Coburn explains it, these guys really have carved themselves out a state, and they may be surrounded by enemies, but none of their enemies can really take them. The lines may be more or less where they're going to end up as far as Kurdistan and Shiistan and Assadistan in western Syria and that kind of thing, but no one seems really ready and willing, able to invade, except maybe the Americans could try to drop the whole damn Marine Corps in there to sack Mosul. But even then, that would be an absolute disaster that Obama clearly doesn't want to do. And so I'm not saying I accept the premise that something must be done about this regime. But for sake of argument, accepting the premise, what is to be done? It seems like a pretty bad conundrum here. What are we going to do? Ally with the Quds Force or, you know, try to get the Turks, who seem to not mind ISIS that much, to invade for us or something like that? Or what's going to happen here?
Yeah. So the best way to fight a group like ISIS actually is to starve it to death. So what you would want to do, because at the end of the day, so the awakening in Iraq that drove the ISI to obscurity, that happened before the surge. It started happening before the surge. And you don't actually, and it probably would have, I'm going to be releasing a piece soon that demonstrates that the surge might have actually had sort of a dampening effect on that. And Baghdadi, as I point out in the piece, is well aware that the Iraqi and Syrian people at some point are going to rise up against him. So what you want to do is make them weaker at that point. So you want to cut off the flow of funds. You want to cut off the flow of arms, especially. And so a lot of the money and arms and resources that, for instance, America has been sending to the Syrian rebels and the rebels in Libya, et cetera, have been ending up in the hands of ISIS. So you want to cut that. You want to try to restrict the flow of people. You're talking about border security in places like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and to prevent people from joining the fight. So you do those kinds of things, it will dramatically weaken ISIS. This is because the whole reason they're able to sustain themselves is because they have a viable economy doing things like selling oil, et cetera. So if you cut that sort of stuff, they won't be able to provide a functional government domestically, the people will eventually rise up against them, and they're going to be in a weakened state to resist them. So you try to contain them, and then you starve them off. That's the best way. If you do big ground forces invasions, it's only going to make them stronger. And the cost of like definitively and decisively defeating them is more than I think anyone is willing to pay. From over the last 60 years, only 7% of insurgencies have been won by military means. And that's because usually counterinsurgency and counterterror methods tend to empower the groups that you're trying to fight.
Mm-hmm.
If you're talking about a kinetic approach.
But most of that's so problematic itself, too. I mean, another regime of sanctions. I mean, it is. You can't help but know, yeah, that, hey, they're surrounded by enemies. They're landlocked. They'll never have any open trade relations with any neighboring state. So that's good. But, you know, we think the price is worth it to starve a bunch of men, women, and children into somehow overthrowing their regime in a new awakening. That sounds just like the Clintonian policy that got us into this mess in the first place. Back in the 1990s.
Oh, you know, I was referring to not starving the people, but starving the group. So, for instance, preventing them from getting access to weapons, preventing them from getting foreign funding from places like Saudi Arabia, clamping down on bank money laundering, for instance, HSBC.
But open trade as far as food resources then?
No, I mean, that doesn't work. That kind of scarcity, imposing scarcity, can actually empower the people that you're trying to fight also. And we saw that, for instance, with imposing sanctions on Iran, imposing sanctions on Iraq. They usually empower the Russia, even. The leader becomes more popular. The people become more dependent on that person, usually.
Yeah,
and
thanks
the
for clarifying that.
Sanctions,
I want to make sure we got that right. Thank you very much, Musa. Great article, and appreciate your time on the show again today.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
That's Musa Al-Gharib.